So let's take a moment to just bring our minds to rest. So that we can focus our attention on these aspirations and intentions we're expressing. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. In Buddha, Dharma, and the Sangha, I take refuge till I awaken to all the virtues such as giving. May I reach Buddhahood for beings. Prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, urging, supplicating, whatever virtue I've collected, I dedicate it to awakening. The ground perfumed and strewn with flowers, Meru for continent, sun, and moon, this imagined Buddha field offering, may all beings dwell in the pure realms. According to the different propensities of beings, please turn the wheel of Dharma, great, lesser, and uncommon. And we'll leave the rest of the prayers for Lama Jinzong to do before she begins teaching. So today we're going to do a guided meditation on the six realms. We're going to start with a short period of bringing the mind to rest through the breath or open awareness. And these teachings, this meditation is based on a little bit Pema Chödrön's teachings on the six realms, and mostly a classic text by Taranatha called The Three Types of Beings, published in English as Essence of Ambrosia. So you can bring the mind to rest. You can follow your breath, or you can just go straight to open awareness. So we're going to bring to mind one by one each of the six realms of existence. Taranatha presents them in his classic text from, I think, the 18th century as physical rebirths, like reasons that we should practice the Dharma so that when we die, we don't end up stuck in one of these places. But we can also remember that they are psychological states that we can become caught up in. And as the descriptions are read, we can feel, the idea is to feel compassion for each realm, because we know what those emotions feel like the associated emotion that plunges you into the realm, but we're not trying to recreate a feeling of being in the realm as we did with Pema Chödrön's and Tim Olmsted's meditations at the beginning of this course. And at the end of each contemplation, we'll do a few rounds of taking and sending. So the idea here is to really, like, we study the six realms, and we're going to continue to study them with Lama Jinzong, but sometimes we don't, it doesn't connect with our heart so much as like it's just information. So here we're going to try to connect with our hearts and really feel for these beings who are trapped in these states. So we're going to start with the hell realms, and Pema Chödrön says hell is the projection of an enraged mind, and the feeling is you're against me, everything is against me. So that's the psychological state. She says hell beings feel like they're on fire and everything is their adversary. There is no way to get away, because everything they encounter is against them. Everything they see enrages them more, and it feels like it lasts forever. So we can relate to that, you know, on the basis of having experienced anger ourselves. These are the hot hells, if I didn't say that. There's the hot hells and the cold hells. So first the hot hells. And what Taranatha says about them is, in all the hot hells, the flat ground is made of burning iron. Flames constantly blaze on arm's length and height. Jagged ravines and precipices cut through the landscape. The water in rivers and lakes takes the form of scorching molten metal and boiling salt water. Even the trees are made of scalding iron. Harmful birds, flesh-eating animals, karmic demons, and murderers roam these realms. The fire in the first level of hell burns 7 times hotter than ordinary fire, and each lower level is 7 times hotter than the one above it. The mind of a hell being is extremely sensitive, stabbed and blinded by feeling. A hell being's body is soft and his flesh tender, like that of a newborn baby. Neither body nor mind can tolerate the slightest pain, so suffering in the hell realms is extremely intense. So let's just take a moment to think of the beings who are caught in these states of existence or states of mind and breathe in that suffering. Some pretty strong, intense suffering to breathe in, but when we breathe it in, we breathe it in wholeheartedly, and we just let it dissolve into the vast expanse of our Buddha nature. We don't hold on to it. It doesn't need to affect us. But we sincerely wish to free hell beings from this suffering. So we breathe it in, let it dissolve, and breathe out to them peace, happiness, awakening, an end to their suffering, an end to their anger. Really breathing in the heat, the burning heat, the feeling of everything against me, the sensitivity, everything hurts. Breathing out all the antidotes. Including people who are in our realm, but just so caught in anger, hot lashing out kind of anger. And now we'll move on to the cold hells, because anger can be either hot or cold. Pema Chidren says that in the cold hells, everything is ice on your bare skin, which cracks open from it. Cold anger feels like that. So Taranatha says, beings are born in the cold hells because they have the sensation of being burned in a fire, and wishing to cool off, seek the cold hell as relief. So you feel the burning of the anger, for example, and it's too intense, and so you move into that cold, freezing out kind of anger that feels more comfortable, except that it's not. Taranatha says that there's no relief because in the cold hells, the ground, mountains, and valleys are snow and ice, slashed with crevices and ravines. Violent icy winds and snowstorms rage constantly over the landscape. The winds are so cold that they penetrate skin and chill flesh to the very bone. Each of the 8 cold hells is 7 times colder than the one above it. So breathing in the suffering of those beings who may be caught in physical hell realms in these landscapes, and beings who are caught in cold anger, letting it dissolve into our Buddha nature and breathing out warmth and peace and relief and awakening to the true reality of their situation. Breathing in that cold, breathing out warmth, compassion, love, happiness. Perhaps we could do that the next time someone freezes us out, remembering what intense suffering that they're going through just through having that anger. And now the hungry ghost realm. The emotion here is insatiable neediness or greed. And Pema Chidren says, the hungry ghost realm is almost as intense as the hell realms, characterized by a sense of deficiency. Something is wrong with me, poverty mentality. Everything makes you feel worse about yourself, like a victim, a loser. You always feel like you're starving no matter how much you're given. And the thought behind the hungry ghost realm is there's never enough, or something is wrong with me. And Taranatha describes the suffering of the hungry ghost realms. Hungry ghosts suffer unbearably and constantly from hunger and thirst. Their mouths are like the eye of a needle and their bellies are enormous. They are weary and exhausted from their constant vain effort to find sustenance, and their bodies become emaciated from lack of food and drink. From time to time, they see heaps of food from a distance, but when they arrive, there is nothing left, or it is guarded by a multitude of demons. Sometimes they see a great river of water, but when they arrive at the shore, it has dried up, leaving only sand and stones in the riverbed. If they do find something to eat or drink, it is disgusting, like hot coals, pus, or urine, or it burns up the inside of their bodies. On top of all this, lacking clothing, they are at the mercy of the elements. In the winter, even sunlight feels icy, and in summer, even moonlight feels like flames. Raindrops are like hot coals scorching their skin. Flames leap from the 360 dislocated joints in their bodies. Furthermore, as if that weren't bad enough, seeing each other as enemies, they catch, find, beat, and stab one another, and are constantly in fear of being similarly attacked and killed. Because they are naturally timid and fearful, even when there's no threat, they are completely consumed by terror. The duration of the hungry ghost realm is almost as long as that of the hell realms. So imagining the suffering of the hungry ghosts in their realm, or of anyone who is trapped in neediness, a deficient sense of themselves, and so forth, will breathe in that suffering with this strong, heartfelt desire to relieve them of it. It's going from them into us. We're breathing it in. We're letting it dissolve, and we're breathing out the antidote. We're breathing out everything they need. May they have everything they need. May they never be hungry. May they never feel bad about themselves. May they have peace and happiness. Feeling like we're really freeing them from their suffering. And now the animal realm, caused by ignorance, confusion, and dullness. Pema Chidren says, inhabitants of the animal realm like for things to be predictable. If their routine is interrupted, they can't function well. They get bewildered, confused, upset, dull, or numb. This is the psychological state of the animal realm. They like for things to be the way they want them to be, the way they're used to. And their sort of motto is just trying to get by, just day-to-day routine. Taranatha says, whether they roam the earth's surface, soar through the sky, or are tossed about aimlessly by the waves of the ocean, wild animals prey on one another and live in constant apprehension of being chased and eaten by a predator. Domestic animals are not necessarily better off, being shorn, pierced, branded, beaten, and forced to carry heavy loads. They may endure the suffering and fear of being enslaved or killed for their meat, blood, skin, and bones. Animals also experience hunger, thirst, heat, and cold, comparable to the suffering of the hell and hungry ghost realms. So for all the fear and danger and confusion of the animal realm, we'll breathe it in, let it dissolve, and breathe it out. Breathe out the antidote. Breathe out our own happiness, peacefulness, freedom from fear, safety, and larger perspective. The human realm, Pema Chodron says, and the emotion here is desire, wanting what you don't have. Pema Chodron says, in the human realm, pain and pleasure alternate. There is enough pleasure that you can relax, but enough pain to spur you on. Suffering in the human realm comes from not understanding or accepting this alternation, from wanting to escape pain and achieve permanent pleasure, from hoping that if you can just do everything right, it will finally be all pleasure and no pain. And the motto is, if I could just this, then I would be happy. If only this, then I would be happy. And Taranatha says, humans experience the four great rivers of suffering. Following the suffering of birth, the various sufferings of illness, aging, and death are inevitable. In addition, we have the day-to-day sufferings of seeking what we want but not finding it. And if we do find something, having to protect, guard, and worry about it, the suffering of encountering the unpleasantness of what we don't want, and the suffering of losing those we love or that which we have accumulated. Even if we have not experienced these kinds of suffering yet, we are certain to in the future. So breathing in the psychological state of suffering in the human realm. Being stuck in the three types of suffering, everything is ultimately suffering. Breathing out liberation. Breathing out acceptance of the ups and downs of life. Breathing out the acceptance of the four great rivers that we will inevitably have illness and inevitably get old and inevitably die. Breathing out freedom from suffering because of that. Breathing out acceptance, breathing out liberation. Breathing out appreciation of the precious human life. And then the two gods realms. The not gods realm is characterized by jealousy. And Pema Chodron says it's characterized by competitiveness, rivalry, one-upmanship. And the motto is, I'm the best, but someone might be better than me. She likens the jealous gods realm to the corporate world. And Taranatha says, the jealous gods, the not quite gods, are jealous of the splendor of the gods, their minds constantly ridden with anxiety. Occasionally they must fight the gods, but because their merit is weaker, they must endure the suffering of being killed or beaten, maimed or disabled. They are in a constant state of war, cold war or declared war, and they never win. So breathing in the suffering of never being the best, of wanting to be the best, of always needing to be on your guard against someone who might surpass you. Breathing out ease and acceptance and liberation, contentment. Breathing out rejoicing in the good fortune of others, which is the antidote to jealousy. If we know anyone who's caught up in this kind of mentality, we can think of them. Breathe in their suffering. Breathe out the antidote. And then finally, the gods' realms, which Pema Chodron says are characterized by the luxury of obliviousness. The gods have infinite wealth and comfort, everything they could possibly need or want. The little suffering they do have is first world suffering that slightly interrupts the perfection of their lives. Their favorite restaurant is closed. They get the middle seat on the airplane and so forth. And their phrase is, everything is bliss. And Taranatha says, even the gods' realms have no real happiness. The lowest gods are attacked by the jealous gods and have to deal with them. All gods are absorbed in pleasure and thus unaware that their lives are being exhausted moment by moment in meaningless pursuits. They have no motivation to engage in positive actions, practice the Dharma, or accumulate any merit. At the end of their lives, the gods experience the intense, unforeseen suffering of realizing they are going to die. Their suffering is like that of a mother camel who has lost her child, a snake carried off by a hawk, a fish writhing on hot sand, or a person in a boat adrift on the vast ocean. Because gods have clairvoyance, they are also able to perceive the lower realm where they will be reborn. The resulting mental anguish of all this is even worse than the physical suffering of the three lower realms, and it lasts for the equivalent of over 10,000 human years. So breathing in the suffering that the gods will inevitably experience at the end of their residence in the gods' realm. Breathing in that anguish and the anguish of falling to a lower realm. Breathing in their obliviousness. Letting it dissolve in our Buddha nature and breathing out liberation even from the gods' realm. Now we'll end by just briefly remembering the four thoughts, appreciating the precious human existence, impermanence and death, karma, the law that our own actions determine our future, and the suffering of samsara, that samsara isn't anything else, so we need to free ourselves from it. Taking those four thoughts to heart is the antidote to being caught in any of these six realms. Bringing the teacher or the Buddha briefly to mind above the crown of our head, requesting their blessing to help free ourselves from this prison of samsara. Receiving their blessing, they descend into our heart center. We really feel that they're there radiating love, compassion, and awakening, helping us on our path. And going back to open awareness just for a moment. And now at your own pace, coming back to be ready for a teaching on the suffering of samsara. Okay, Lama Jinzang, you're unmuted.
So I'll just begin. You can continue resting your mind as I chant the four dharmas of Gompopa. These are the prayers to be recited by teachers before teachings. So the first is the four dharmas. O Dada Sanchantan, Jeji Loju Sujo Warsanji Lapduso, Julam Dujo Warsanji Lapduso, Lam Ju Warse Warsanji Lapduso, Jupo Yeshi Sungjo Warsanji Lapduso. I pray for blessing. May my mind and the minds of all sentient beings turn toward the Dharma. I pray for blessing. May the Dharma become the path. I pray for blessing. May the path clarify confusion. I pray for blessing. May confusion arise as wisdom. And then from the aspiration to excellent conduct. Lai ke dam lu dan u ji ke jo bun da ta mi I ke nan ta jo wa kun ji dra ke ji san par tam je ke du da gi ju den do. In the tongues of Nagas, Yakshas, gods, those of demons and of humans too. In the many languages there are, may I teach the Dharma in them all. And now to engender the attitude, the altruistic attitude, as practitioners within the Mahayana Buddhist tradition. Let us begin by giving rise to the thought that in order to benefit all sentient beings whose numbers fill the extent of space, I must attain the level of perfect enlightenment. In order to bring this about, I will practice the profound Mahayana Dharma by way of study, contemplation, and meditation. And then, Chidren, am I supposed to do the first of the impermanence? Do you do that one verse of impermanence, flickering stars, or that's not necessary? No? Okay.
Yeah, we don't need to do that.
Okay. So thank you, everyone. So Lama Chidren just did a beautiful meditation, and very nicely, because I had not actually gone through the higher realms last week, but I think that she, in her exposition, covered them very nicely. So thank you very much. I'm just going.
Sorry, I did not mean to jump the gun.
It's okay. So I today will just be working with Path to Buddhahood. We're on page. I'm just going to backtrack a little just to remind us of what we already talked about. So I'm on the second antidote. That's page 37. So again, it says, contemplating the misery of samsara. As long as we are in the samsaric state of mind, we will not find complete satisfaction and happiness. Samsara is suffering by definition. It is a state of mind characterized by the presence of varying degrees of the three types of suffering. Therefore, we need to get out of it. Fortunately, this is possible. That is the point of contemplating the misery of samsara. So again, it's to remind us that although we're discussing how we are entrapped, it's not a point of just to feel helpless and lost, but to stir us on, because we have the means through the various methods and teachings to avoid, to cut through, to purify, and to remove ourselves, free ourselves from suffering. So I'll just reiterate a little bit about the three types of suffering. So continuing in the book, it says the first form of suffering is what Gunther translated as the suffering of conditioned existence. A literal translation of the Tibetan would be the suffering inherent to all that is composite. Again, all that is composite is all beings that are the coming together of infinite number of conditions, physical and mental, and come together. And as we know from the four ends, whatever, you know, is composite will, whatever comes together will eventually fall apart. Continuing the text, it says, are you hearing that ding? No, we're okay. Okay. Most people, so I'm continuing the book, most people do not even notice the suffering. So again, this is the suffering of conditioned existence. And what does this mean? It means that everything changes all the time, but we're conditioned to believe the opposite. So we think that what's impermanent is permanent. We think that something that is a fleeting source of happiness is in fact a true unchanging source of happiness. So we put all our trust into that which is illusory, and we allow ourselves to, or we delude ourselves into thinking that what's a true source of happiness, a true unchanging source of happiness, that something that is not a unchanging source of happiness is a true unchanging source of happiness. So again, in the book, we cling to this belief, thinking that it brings happiness and security. But even the things we most cling to, the ones that seem to bring us the most stability, are transient. We are not free, but conditioned and stuck in our own karma. We are constantly controlled without knowing it by innumerable causes and results which we ourselves have created. So that this means that we're controlled by our own conditioning, which in this context is defined as our own personal chain of karmic actions and reactions. Again, in the book, without any control or even awareness of this phenomena, we cannot escape from it. This lack of freedom keeps us from enjoying total happiness. And as we learned last week, in fact, though, that this particular, suffering of conditioned experience is a neutral experience. We're not actually even conscious of it. And the reason is because we are overtaken by the next two, which is, it comes with the second type of suffering is called the suffering of change. So although it's described as the anxiety that accompanies our anticipation of change, the fact is that the suffering of change is not experienced as suffering per se. It's the pleasure we're actually experiencing, but the underlying idea that everything being impermanent and nothing can remain, there is the imminent and inevitable loss and feelings of disappointment that will come when the change occurs. So we'll skip on to the next one, page 38, where it says the third type of suffering is called the suffering of suffering. So this is the real suffering, the kind of experience when we are sick, when we are about to die, when we lose what we love, or when we are confronted with what we hate. This is what we usually call suffering. So it's the actual experience of suffering. And now I'm going to skip to the very bottom of the page, where it says the constant change. So that's the very last sentence on page 38. The constant change we experience in our lives is part of this. The constant change we experience in our lives is part of the same process like the string of rebirths. Each change is conditioned, or you can say influenced, by a multitude of factors. All phenomena are conditioned by each other. We are continually carried, pushed forward with little personal choice. Of course, we have a certain degree of choice, but this choice itself is conditioned as long as our mind is not free from attachment and the other mind poisons. The pressures and demands of modern life can give us an idea of the limits of our own room for maneuvering. And now I'm going to skip to now where it says rebirth. And it says, Kampopa also warns us of the danger of being attached to our problems and the risk of drowning in our own sufferings. We must understand their true nature. After defining what suffering is, Kampopa describes the specific way it manifests in each of the six realms. So last week I did what Lama Chodron just did, which is I went through originally I'd been working from Luminous Mind, this book by Kala Rinpoche, and we had gotten and interlacing that with Pema Chodron's explanations, whereas Luminous Mind goes through the more physical descriptions of the realms. Pema Chodron goes through the psychological description of the realms, and we covered the three lower realms. And today I was going to do the three higher realms, but since Lama Chodron just gave such a lovely meditation on the human realm, the jealous God realm, and the divine realm, I'll skip over that because I was going to cover that same content. So now we're going to continue with Path to Buddhahood. So again, I'm on page 39, continuing. It says, so speaking of Gampopa, it says, he warns us against the attachment we might feel for one or another of these realms, and on the other hand, encourages us to develop the firm determination to break with suffering, leave samsaric existence far behind, and reach true enlightenment. Here we come to the question of rebirth. And I just find this was, for me, very meaningful because this is one of the first places, probably one of the only places I've ever, not that I'm a great reader, so I shouldn't say that there aren't a multitude of sources to read about rebirth, but this was the first time I was introduced from a teacher who had such a good sense of Western culture and sensibility. So I'll continue now. Here we come to the question of rebirth. It is sometimes difficult for Westerners to integrate this idea, as rebirth is not part of their cultural background. It is actually only one aspect of interdependence and the lack of intrinsic existence of self and phenomena. For someone who comes from a culture where this idea goes without saying, it seems just as strange not to believe in it. Actually, almost all the life forms around us go through this process of rebirth. Let's take flowers, grass, and trees, for example. Everything around us dies and is reborn again and again. This flower is the result of the previous one. One flower wilts, its roots dig down in the earth, and when the right conditions come together, earth, water, sun, another flower is born from the same root. Almost all the life forms around us repeat this cycle. According to Buddhism, our successive lives are not like a necklace. I suppose he's talking about like a mala, you know, with beads on it, where each life is a bead and the string is the soul going through all of them. The Buddhist philosophy denies the existence of a spirit or a soul that goes from one body to the next, as if one changes clothes, even if sometimes this is what is presented in the beginning to help people understand the process. When we go on to the next life, nothing is transferred. Nothing goes from one place to another. To illustrate this essential point, Gompopa gives 8 examples, but we will look at only 4 of them. The first example is of yogurt. How does milk become yogurt? Milk is not yogurt, and yogurt is not milk. When it is milk, there is not yet yogurt. And when it becomes yogurt, there is no longer milk. There can't be yogurt without milk, but milk disappears when yogurt appears. It is not that something goes out of milk and enters yogurt. So nothing really goes out of us. Our present conditions create our next moment as well as our next life. So the point is that when it says it's not that something goes out of milk and enters yogurt, so it's not as if milk and yogurt are existing at the same time, that there's something physically that's moving from one life to the next. And this brings us back to an even more profound notion that, again, ultimately, nothing substantially exists materialistically. So to even construe that there's some form of some sort of stuff, some kind of entity like the soul or something that continues is not what is being described here. Again, it says it's not that something goes out of milk and enters into yogurt, so that somehow milk is somehow inside yogurt. The minute it's yogurt, the milk is finished. So nothing really goes out of us. Our present conditions create our next moment as well as our next life. Another example is the mirror. When we look in a mirror, we see a reflection in it. But how does that image appear there? Our face does not travel. No part of our face is transferred into the mirror, yet its form appears. And without our own face, there would be no reflection in the mirror. Now let's suppose a candle is lit, and we light a second candle with the first. How does the flame go from one to the other? If we watch a candle flame, it burns constantly from the beginning until the candle is completely burned down. Is it the same flame or not? Is there one flame or are there many? So just like the mirror example and the flame example, the fact is that it isn't that one flame that the face is actually going into the mirror, or that the flame that you initiated the second candle with is still there. It's just that it created the next, it became the cause for the result, which was the various conditions together, the wick, the heat, etc., whatever it is that caused that wick to flame up. And then again, the heat as it's traveling up with the conditions of the wick, with the wax, etc., it's continually a new event, but it's connected in the way that a cause creates a result. So when it says, so continuing, it says, let's take another example. At this moment, I'm here. Why? Because I was here the moment before. Why am I here? I could say it's because I was born. Actually, if I had never been born, I wouldn't be here at all. My birth is one of the numerous factors of my presence here. If I was born but didn't grow up, if I had died young, I wouldn't be here either. My youth is therefore the cause of my presence here. I can also answer that if I'm here, it's because of yesterday. I didn't die yesterday. And so I'm still here. So again, it's because if I'm here, I read that a little funny. It says, I can also answer that if I'm here, it's because of yesterday. I didn't die yesterday. And so I'm still here. My presence here and now is the result of my past. However, that past doesn't mean that I've always been the way I am. Therefore, one can't talk about herself. So this is very, very important. This is referring to what is described as when you talk about why you can't say there's a self. Kenpo Sotran Jamsa Rinpoche, I guess I can pull this source out. Hold on for a second. In his text known as The Progressive Stages of Meditation of Emptiness, in describing what a self is, or our illusion that a self exists, he says the three characteristics that you have to fulfill in order for something to truly have meaning is that they be lasting, single, and independent. So I don't know, there's a book out now, it's a new form, but this is a very old form, but I just thought that I would just read this one paragraph. I don't know where it is in the new publication, but it says, to have any meaning, such a self has to be lasting. For if it perished every moment, one would not be so concerned about what was going to happen to it the next moment. It would not be oneself anymore. So it has to be lasting. Again, it has to be single. If one head note separate, when they say single, that seems to be synonymous with separate. If one had no separate or single identity, why should one worry about what happened to oneself anymore? Why should one worry any more than one worried about anyone else's? It has to be independent, or there'd be no sense in saying, I did this or I have that. If one had no independent existence, there would be no one to claim the actions and experiences as its own. We all act as if we had lasting, separate, independent selves that it is our constant preoccupation to protect and foster. So I just wanted to bring that up because the text started introducing this concept of therefore one can't talk about a self because it's not something that continues where it says back into Path to Buddhahood. Again, it says, my presence here, I'm top of 41, my presence here now is the result of my past. However, that past doesn't mean that I've always been the way I am. Therefore, one can't talk about a self. Does anyone, I should stop, because this is pretty deep stuff. I didn't know if anyone, does anyone have any questions, or should I keep going until the next two pages where this section ends, and then we can begin a discussion. I think that's Joanne. Let's see. Hold on, we have to unmute you. Okay, Joanne.
The title of that previous publication that you read from?
It's called, and you can find it on Amazon, it's Progressive Stages of Meditation on Emptiness.
Okay. Thank you, Lama. Mm-hmm.
What's your page number, Jinzong, on
that book?
Yeah.
On this version?
Yeah.
20. Page okay. 20.
Okay. Thanks.
So continuing again, I'm back with Path to Buddhahood, page 41. From the Buddhist point of view of rebirth, in the same way that the present moment produces the next, this present life is the cause of the next one. The last moment produces the next moment. This is not different from the way a flower grows. What we are now was created, conditioned by our past. If we hadn't been children, we wouldn't be the adults we are now. Yet we are no longer that child. We may have some white hair, some wrinkles. That child and we are one and at the same time different. Our present life and our future life have a similar relationship. The present circumstances, our situation, our actions, our present thoughts produce the next moment. The circumstances, actions, and thoughts of the next moment condition the following moment, and so on. So what we are now conditions our future. It's a continuous process. And this is what proves that I'm here now, because I was here yesterday and the day before. How can we know that we were alive yesterday? How do we know it with certainty? What's the proof? Yesterday could have been a dream. Our only proof of having existed yesterday is that we exist today. So we have this notion that we didn't just suddenly arise out of nowhere. You know, like in the dream state, you do have people popping up all over the place as if suddenly you've just arisen, or your experience of yourself is suddenly in a set of conditions that when you wake up, you're like, whoa, that's not like my regular, you know, so-called relative waking state. So the point here is, it's because this is what comes next, is that the only proof, again, it says that our only proof of existing yesterday is that we exist today. If we were not here today, we couldn't have been anywhere yesterday. So we have to look at our own experience and begin to really investigate this. It says again, if we were not here today, we couldn't have been anywhere yesterday. The proof of tomorrow is our existence today. We don't disappear. We'll also be here tomorrow, but perhaps in another form. So what this is saying is that obviously we might die, but that doesn't mean, again, there won't be some kind of awareness of experience. And it could take the form with a different set of perceptions. So again, another form. So from our own experience is this idea, when you can think of, my gosh, you know, is there a future life? Well, you think, where in our experience do we have any proof that things just miraculously disappear? In our actual experience, I don't have anything. I mean, I have the experience of forgetting things and the fact that I have a sense that, you know, I have no idea what I thought about as a child. Those moments are all gone. But somehow I'm under the what is supporting this notion that there somehow is an independent, single, lasting self, is the sense that even though I have no idea who that child was, except from some maybe pictures that I can think of, or some neurosis, you know, neurotic moments that come to mind, I still think somehow that child is me, is still somehow a continuation of myself. That proves that I'm some kind of lasting self or lasting person. And so the next paragraph, it says, our body changes, everything changes. Our feelings of I am, what I was when I was a child, that child was me, I will be that old person, is our self-identification. It's the main element that links us to our identity and continues in the next life. Whether we see ourselves as a child, an adult, or an old person, we think, this is me. In the same way, in our next life, we will think, this is me, even if the conditions have changed. So this point, that this notion of self-identification, that we continually have this notion that is nothing other than a psychological experience. It's a sense of self that we have, that we impute and we apply to a constantly changing set of conditions. Our emotions, our actions, our karma constantly create numerous conditions. These conditions won't suddenly disappear at our death. When one shoots an arrow, it continues its trajectory and necessarily falls somewhere. It will not suddenly vaporize in midair. These conditions must be contained in a future, in a later event. There must therefore be a continuation, which is the next life. This is how we explain the series of existences. The next life will not, however, be exactly the same. We will be different from who we are in this life. Nothing of our body nor of our mind is transferred from one life to another. The next life is caused, created by our present conditioning. It is not an exact reproduction of what we are now. So this we can look at, again, our own life example, at our own timeline, and look to see that regardless, even now our body has nothing to do with our previous body as a child, as a baby. You know, we've grown. We see the changes in our bodies going on. Our thoughts have changed endlessly in our dream states. Thoughts arise endlessly that have nothing to do with our physical state. And yet there is this sense of I that is experiencing this. And this is what is being brought out here, I think, that it's impossible for us to understand this conceptually, because it's impossible for me anyway at this point to know that, you know, the whole point being that there is awareness, there is that which knows, but that knower doesn't exist substantially. And so this idea is that in our own lives, constantly conditions arise, and based on our own emotional propensities, our mental, you know, dispositions, choices are made that then condition the next choice, because one choice results in a certain, you know, result, and then that conditions our next action. And that is how it goes on. And there's always a moment of awareness that in this deluded state, we have a sense that there is someone who is thinking that I am aware. But that awareness, that moment of awareness, is never exactly the same moment of awareness. It's a continuing, it's a continuum of moments of awareness. So this is what explains how, according to Buddhist philosophy, if we understand the non-existence of ego, we could manifest in 2, 3, or 4, or 100 different incarnations. So it is said that a being who has reached the first bhumi, so that's the first bodhisattva level, can manifest as 100 emanations. Whoever has reached the second bhumi can manifest as 100,000, and so on in growing numbers. What that means is that our freedom grows proportionately to our understanding of the true natures of things, and that we acquire control over mind and matter. So that, I guess, our perception, without clinging to there being an independent single form that we define as ourself, we no longer are limited by how we can manifest, how we can think of ourselves, if there's even that notion of thinking of ourselves, but that somehow there's the ability to perceive many different kinds of forms that you can then benefit, that other beings can connect with, and that they can be benefited by those forms. Continuing in the book, it says, the process of death is a dissolution. Life, the body, the mind, everything dissolves. The next mental structure is the product of this process, and so on, at each moment. In the same way, our previous life was not identical to the life we lead now. But it was not completely different either. What we are is the product of our previous life. Someone who was very interested in spirituality in the last life probably has the same propensity in this life. This is what we call karmic imprints. Different karmic imprints create different categories of people. This may lead some to fall into the trap of a passive attitude, thinking, I'm the result of my past, and since what I am is the consequence of karmic imprints, I can't do anything about it. Of course, we can't change what we are now, because we are already what we are. There is nothing we can do about it, because it is the result of our past. But we can partially control what we will be in the future. If the past made our present, our present can in turn make our future. What we can be in the next moment, next year, and our next life is in our hands right now. So I thought what I would do is just finish reading the last section, which is the six realms, and then open it up to discussion. So that way we'll be sure to finish this chapter. So I'm just going to continue. We're on page 43. The six realms, contrary to what some Westerners tend to think, There is no particular destiny attached to specific actions. Let's take suicide as an example. Committing suicide means taking a life, which is considered to be very negative. However, from a Buddhist point of view, what we do or do not do is not the only criterion determining whether an action is considered good, bad, or very bad. The essential criterion is the underlying motivation for the action. We need to correctly understand the theory of karma. Karma is the conditioning that we create. Whatever we do, any action will have consequences. Karma develops from this conditioning, which directly creates the next moment. Karma is not the long-term result of what we do now. It is a process of actions and reactions. The effects can be felt in the short or long term, but the most important thing is to understand that whatever we do, there will be consequences. The same goes for the six realms. For example, rebirth in a hell realm is the result of our conditioning. Hatred, anger, and our negative thoughts become more real, more tangible, and thus we find ourselves in a hell realm. It isn't a place where one is sent. In a single place, different beings can experience the hells, paradise, or the human world. Take, for example, water. It is perceived in a different way by the beings who inhabit each of the six realms. A human will see it as a refreshing drink, a hell being as molten metal, and a hungry ghost as poison. A fish will consider it as its living environment, and a god will see it as a nectar of long life and beauty. These different viewpoints are simply the result of our own conditioning, our own chain of karmic actions and reactions. According to Buddhism, these different realms are states of mind generated by the six negative emotions. Beings dominated by hatred and anger will be reborn in the hells. Very greedy beings will be born in the realm of hungry ghosts. The predominance of desire is the cause of rebirth in the human realm. If ignorance, stupidity, and confusion are dominant, one is born as an animal. If jealousy is very strong, one is born in the world of the jealous demigods. If pride is predominant, one is then born among the gods. These six negative emotions characterize the six states of mind that constitute what we call samsara. We need to perceive and recognize the three types of suffering that pervade the six realms, wherever we are born, and whatever our life form. Within samsara, there is neither complete happiness nor total freedom. The only way to reach them is to, meaning complete happiness or freedom. The only way to reach them is to liberate ourselves from the samsaric state of mind by realizing the true quality of Buddha nature and by developing it. This realization frees us completely from confusion and false beliefs and leads us to enlightenment. So I'll open it up. Does anyone have any questions or comments? Dave?
Okay, Dave, I'm muted.
Yeah.
I had a question. When you were discussing the self, the three elements, from progressive stages of the meditation on emptiness. So you had lasting, single or separate, and independent. So this would be like the characteristics that would be involved if the self had inherent existence.
Correct.
Is that true? Are those three elements like the basis for anything that would have inherent existence or just self?
Anything? Anything, correct.
Okay.
Anything, that's true. That was part of the problem because I don't know how far, you know, in this book to go with, you know, this progressive stages of meditation emptiness is the first chapter on the meditation of non-self. And I didn't know how to, you know, how much to introduce in the right context of this course. So I didn't actually prepare any further. There's, you know, I could give more, but I could read a little bit. Would that be okay? I mean, just a few paragraphs from this text. Is that all right if no one else has any?
I'm always good with it, but whatever everybody else wants.
Well, if there don't seem to be any questions yet. So I'm in page 20, Jidren. So he says, so after saying that, you know, the self doesn't have these qualities of lasting single and independent, it says, we all act as if we had lasting, separate, interdependent selves, that it is our constant preoccupation to protect and foster. It is an unthinking habit that most of us would normally be unlikely to question or explain. However, all our suffering is associated with this preoccupation. All loss and gain, pleasure and pain arise because we identify so closely with this vague feeling of selfness that we have. We are so emotionally involved with and attached to this self, in, you know, quotes, that we have... we take it for granted. Westerners often confuse self in this context with person, ego, or personality. They argue that they do not think of the person, ego, or personality as a lasting, single, independent entity. This is to miss the point. The person, personality, or ego, as such, are not a problem. One can analyze them quite rationally into their constituent parts. The Western tradition has all sorts of ways of doing this. And the Buddhist way is to talk about the what are called the five aggregates, which is the body and the different categories of mental activity. It says, which is used to say that, can you find that which is defined as a single self existing from its own side, independent of any other conditions, can you find it in this body or in this mind, which when broken down is made up of infinite numbers of things that you can keep breaking it down and subatomically everything is broken down. It's always something is made of something else, or that something has different, you know, has different, like even an atom or something has sides to it, so you can't call it as a singular entity, whatever. The point is, it says, the question is not whether or not the person, personality, or ego is a changing composite train of events conditioned by many complex factors. Any rational analysis shows us that this is the case. The question is, why then do we behave emotionally as if it were lasting, single, and independent? Thus, when looking for the self, it's very important to remember it is an emotional response that one is examining. When one responds to events as if one had a self, for example, when one feels very hurt or offended, one should ask oneself who or what exactly is feeling hurt or offended.
Nice.
Yeah. I don't want to go into any further because it gets a little more, you know, specific to this text, but yes, Deirdre?
I've unmuted Deirdre.
Okay, Deirdre.
So is it like, could you say that there's like recognition of ego and then there's clinging to ego? Because like one is the suffering, the clinging. I mean, just the recognizing that there is awareness rather than maybe ego, but then clinging to that as an entity is like where the suffering comes in.
Yeah. So I think that really what's the issue is like, it, you know, we can rationally, intellectually say, well, right, there isn't someone, but somehow we're still somehow emotionally thinking that awareness is somehow my awareness, like we're still sort of experiencing. And so what the meditations that are taught is to begin to look at that which is thinking I know or I'm aware or awareness, to be able to ultimately recognize that that is always empty of any substantiality. So to think of it as like as awareness as being just constant, like infinite potential, you know? And so there's like anything can happen and somehow there is the awareness. I mean, this gets into very high end stuff that you can't really talk about. I mean, you can talk about it, but to really understand it. So, yeah, I think that what you're talking about is there's the clinging, but it's that we're clinging to the conceptuality about ego or the words themselves, awareness, and we're not yet able to really know that it's all experience, but there's nothing existence. It's like holographic or a rainbow where you see it, but you can constantly put your hand through it. There's never any solidity to it. So like, you know, when they talk about like mind is not empty like space, we say often mind is like space. It's open and anything can happen. But mind is not like space because space can't create anything or nothing. Space is that which anything can arise within. But the fact that mind has this luminous quality, so anything can arise, and it actually knows that it's arising, but it isn't someone or something or the ego or anything else or some substantial thing that knows. And therefore, this whole idea that you could remove yourself from samsara because there's never any sense that there's something that can be harmed. That's my feeble attempt at trying to explain it.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I think the stages, I think in one of the Dharma path, one of the stages was, it's like we can't let go of the idea of a self, but we can start to let go of the clinging, you know, just like going from point A to the top of the mountain, from the ground to the mountain, that and I think that's like why in the 7-point mind training, it was so helpful with those exercises to kind of shout at ego clinging, like, here you are again, you crazy ego clinging.
Well, you know, it's clinging, like you're saying, that really is the problem, because like in even Shinne, it's always saying that, you know, mind is a dynamic phenomena. Movement is part of, that's the nature of mind. It's not a stagnant, it's a concept or phenomena, you know, it's dynamic. And so like thoughts that arise, appearances that arise, anything, that's not the problem. It's clinging. And what is it that we're actually clinging to? It's the clinging to the fact that whatever is arising, we impute truly existent, you know, that it's truly existent in the sense that it's existing independent of our perception of it, independent of any conditions. So clinging is sort of synonymous with falsely attributing, you know, true existence to that which is not, is just mere appearance, you know, that it's not truly existence.
I've unmuted Marilyn and Patrick.
Oh, please.
I this is a rather different kind of subject, sort of. I'm thinking about the all bases based consciousness, the Alaya, which carries the imprints of our karma. And I've always had a challenge thinking about what that is in relationship to death and rebirth. Does anybody want to, I mean, because it doesn't, would anybody like to attempt to explain that, or is it not relevant to the class?
Oh, it's very relevant. It's in the sense that I think that that's this notion of, again, when it said, or, you know, at one point that it's not like there's a soul or something that's like the mala, you know, where you have a mala, where somehow this alaya, this all basis is the string that somehow is continuing through body, or whatever, that it's because I think that, you know, so in my mind, that alaya almost is like a soul in this, if they're somehow, we can't conceive of it as not being physical somehow, because this whole notion that you could have something that continues without any materiality is inconceivable, at least to my mind. And the only thing that helped me at some point was when I realized when it says that, well, if there's nothing that's unchanging, everything's impermanent, what does it say to say that the the true nature of mind is unchanging, as if that implies there's something that actually exists in an unchanging way. And when I came to begin to understand that, it's not saying that there's this awareness that you have, which is the alaya consciousness, whatever that manifests in certain ways, you know, is something that's existing in any form of duration. It's something that is constantly in each moment dissolving, and then some, you know, to get not to get more complex, but they're all descriptions which I don't totally understand, but how that somehow then the next moment of awareness, the next moment of this alaya whatever arises, and it's not the same as the previous one, but it has similar qualities, so that you're not talking about an entity that continues. And I don't know that any of us can truly, conceptually cannot grasp it because we don't, it's inconceivable to understand that. But I think that that's this idea that in every moment, you know, nanosecond, whatever, there's awareness. And awareness always has the same qualities. There's movements, it's luminous, it's, you know, it's unbounded, it's, you know, unhindered. But it's not the same moment of awareness. It's different. So that's why this idea that when you carry, like it's saying, in each moment, it's not the same moment, that somehow each moment becomes the cause of the next moment, but it's just like the milk turning into yogurt. It's never that the previous moment is somehow existing at the same time as the next moment. Milk is never yogurt. The minute it transforms into yogurt, it's no longer milk. So somehow this idea is that in each moment, it conditions relatively, there are conditions that arise so that the next moment arises similarly, so that, and it appears to be the same, but it's not actually the same thing. Like, I guess it's like relatively, and this is where we have to be careful not to confuse relative and ultimate. So, but relatively, I guess it's like when you have the old film that goes through a 35 millimeter film, when you watch the old time movies before video, you know, you had film strips that were single frame, a line, and a single frame and a line, but because it moves really quickly, and mind relatively can't see the difference, mind interprets it as being continuous. And it's an interpretation of a series of individual moments of awareness that we can't relatively experience as singular. And so we sort of experience it in a coarse way as all being part of the same. So that's one, that's what I have to say. I don't know if that.
I sort of got that already. Not that I'm not happy to have it reiterated. I'm still struggling with the rebirth part of it. So mm-hmm. I think maybe it's just my trying to conceptualize something and it's not working. And so I better just relax.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, just relax. I mean,
well, I mean, also relax because this is what's been going on our whole lives. I mean, the fact that we're not a child anymore. And each time we've changed, we've constantly gone through like countless dissolutions and then rearousals. And we don't have any memory of it. If it was a single thing, somehow we would have been able to remember it. But the fact that, you know, I don't have any, you know, as a teenager. So the fact is we say we can't conceive of it, but look at our actual life experience. The fact that we're so different now than where we were before and where we're going to be, you know, we can't conceive it at individual moments, but if you look at years, year by year, there's change going on constantly. And so it's, you know, and I'll shut up after this, but the idea is that it's already that way. We're struggling with how is it possible, but it already is that way. And like you, I just have to just then relax because it's nothing that we can conceive of through words. We can't understand it, you know. I don't know, Lama Chodron, if you have anything to add at this point. That's the best I can do.
No, I mean, I think it's good to grapple with it, Marilyn. That's the study and contemplation aspect. But we got to depend on the meditation direct experience aspect to sort it all out. I think that all the conceptualization, it helps, but we have to remember that that's just part of the process. So we keep at it, but we don't have to solve it. We're not going to solve it. So somebody had a hand up. Okay, Joanne, and then Dave.
Lama Junsong and Lama Troden, at the bottom of page 42 in Path to Buddhahood, those last two sentences are rather powerful. And again, I keep that as a framework when I embark in each new day. Can you expound on those last two sentences?
Because you mean if the past made our present yeah. could in turn make the future?
In our hands right now. That's powerful.
Yes, well, the idea is that it's not destiny. Just because what we did previously, certain conditions have arisen now, but we can change because through meditation, we've learned through like Shinne meditation, calm abiding, through all the practices of 7 points of mind training, of 37 practices of the Bodhisattva, all the training that we're starting to work with and through meditation practice, looking at our mind and being able to go, that's a thought. And I don't actually have to do anything with it. So we're able to, although now anger might arise due to certain conditions that have come together because of our training, we can begin to develop the ability to actually change, and it's the only thing we can change, of how we perceive or interpret our own thoughts. And therefore, we have control, or that's the only thing we have control over, of how we respond to our thoughts, whether we act out or not. And if, for instance, we've had a long history of anger and reacting or overreacting, beginning to gain some insight into that habitual tendency through the meditation and beginning to, you know, especially practicing, it's good sometimes to actually generate those kinds of thoughts, so to bring to mind an image or a set of conditions, and it really puts you into that set of emotionality, of, you know, of upset or whatever. And in that mind, watch your mind and go and apply the training that we've all been working with to like, wait, oops, that's a thought. And what happens if, you know, I'm just going to go, even like, I'm going to return to my breath. What happens? That thought disappears. So beginning to understand that they're just thoughts, that they don't immediately have to control us because that's all they are. They're temporary arisings. And then we can begin to cut our previous habitual tendency or reduce it. We won't further reinforce our ability to just react in the same way we have, you know, whether it's through anger or whatever. And so by not reinforcing it, slowly, slowly, that habit lessens and we're developing a new habit to not react in that way. And that is changing, therefore, what will arise in the future for us.
Thank you, Lama.
Does that make sense?
Yes, very much. Thank you.
Okay, Dave is next, and then Mark.
Going back to the question of the Alaya and the rebirth, because I always thought that was a key thing where I agreed with Buddhism, but I disagreed with Hinduism. You know, like the Hindu model, like you're the driver of the car and you get a new car, similar to the string, but even a little more than the string, like a little more substance or whatever. But I was struck by earlier, I can't remember if it was earlier or later in the Gampopa, because I've been following some of the later teachings on the paramitas that you guys did a couple years ago. But there was like this definition of a person as being like ultimately as being awareness coupled with the five skandhas,
right?
And I mean, from that perspective, could you say that the five skandhas are what gets reincarnated and awareness is pretty much like the Alaya, what goes?
Well, the Alaya, it's, you know, the Alaya, there's a notion here that, you know, I should just briefly introduce and help me, children, because I don't totally remember, but remember that consciousness, there's impure consciousness from the point of view of consciousness that is completely dualistic.
Right.
That's constantly thinking subject and object. And when there's purification through practice, it's what is known as as primordial wisdom. It becomes right. wisdom. So there isn't an Alaya separate from, you know, Alaya consciousness is just a description of consciousness when it's in
when
the
material form.
It's mind itself, which is manifesting awareness itself, which has the ability. That's why this notion of it, thinking of it as empty awareness, inseparable as just infinite potential. Mm-hmm. Anything can arise at any moment. And so there's, from the ignorant side, you have the notion of the consciousnesses, the mental activity, and the various forms that we take. And that's what we then justify our notion of there being a self, because we identify ourselves with the thoughts and the form that we are perceiving. But it's not, it's not so, to the extent that when you become enlightened, apparently, when you purify this, there's still awareness, but it's now from the point of view of wisdom awareness. It's no longer where you have this notion, I believe, of this all basis. It's like all basis consciousness becomes all basis wisdom. Something like that is what I remember. It's that consciousness transforms into wisdom. And whether, I can't remember anymore what it is, but it's like all basis consciousness transforms is now like all, you know, is now whatever the word is for wisdom, you know, in various schools that don't talk about it that way. But again, this is all terminology. These are all concepts. So our trying to understand it through concepts is reinforcing dualistic thinking,
right,
which is illusory, because we're always, that's then implying that we're thinking I, and even my thoughts are other than myself.
Right. Yeah.
So anyway, that's Mark. Is Mark had a question?
Yeah, I'm going to unmute him.
Okay, thanks. I thought that that was really, really, really well explained when you were talking about the continuum between like milk and yogurt and also the candle. And that what's, so in nature mind teachings, there's a trinity, there's a emptiness and clarity, but then there's, and then the third one is this continuum, right? They're unceasing. So it's like we're always having new.
Actually, that's not necessarily, there's different, there are actually different interpretations of what this Magakpa unceasing refers to, just so you know. It's often, sometimes like Kala Rinpoche would even say that it's the fact that, like there was the term unimpeded, that not unceasing, but unimpeded, so that this idea that while there is all the arising, it's always emptiness. So it's unimpeded in that sense. There's nothing, it's not like something becomes empty or something appears. It's always, it's always the same thing. And in that sense, it's unimpeded. Or that you can think of it as that, again, anything can arise because there's nothing to keep it. There's no limitation. There's nothing to limit it because there's no boundaries. So Magakpa, I haven't actually heard that as being unceasing per se. So
that's one way that it's sometimes translated.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure why, but
okay.
Yeah.
It might be a different word they're referring to in that set of teachings, but go on, Mark. Sorry.
Okay, that's okay. So if you take this continuum, let's say, and that you reinforce whatever the last set of thoughts or emotions that you had in the last little interdependent section of the continuum, reinforce that goes into the Alaya, and then that sucks you in on the next
right
part of the continuum. So that one of the ways of breaking it is to not dump more stuff into the Alaya, which then you know attracts you to that same mental right. emotional state again. So to just kind of like put light in there instead of more thoughts and conceptions.
The thing, though, that is important to recognize is then we say dump into the Alaya as if that's a thing that, like, you know, like a bag that you carry with you, that that becomes like the string of it. The point is that in each moment, somehow, that Alaya re-arises. You know, that set of experience somehow are similar. Somehow the propensity for behaving or reacting or responding a certain way is similar to what happened in the previous moment, but it's not the same thing. And I personally won't get that until
I've heard it described as, you know, going into your garage where you've got all this stuff stored with a good light, so you're not just stumbling around bumping into things, but with a good light, and you see that all that stuff that's stored in there in the Alaya is just consciousness. It's just, it is the same thing, like sort of like what you were saying, but it's not anything that's separate from Buddha mind or whatever you want to call it.
That's what I'm saying. Like terms, like they took, like from the enlightened perspective, there is no such thing as consciousness. That's a term that's in the realm of relative reality. And actually, if anyone were to go ahead and get this book, Progressive Stages of Meditation, what it does is it goes through the five schools and the higher and higher teachings. And you get into the whole, like the wordage, like they don't even say conscious anymore. They, you know, they start using, you know, they talk clear light, nature of mind, wisdom mind. I mean, that, depending on what the translation says, the point is it's, you know, the term consciousness itself is in just in the relative
experience. This is a question for lamas. When you're speaking about the continuum, and it seems like it was converging on death and rebirth, right? Seemed like that's what you were saying, was that part of the continuum is like a thought dies and then is reborn.
It's not that the thought dies and is reborn. It's that the propensity, it's just, you know, it's getting a little too abstract for me, and I'm not very good in this arena, but I will say that if we just look back at look at our own life experience, and this idea, like, what happens to the thought we just had, you know, is in fact, you know, and look at our own minds and our own thoughts as they're arising and what happens to them, and begin to just look at that experience. And so when they talk about one thing dying, it's like the fact that a thought arises and then it dissolves is a form of death in that way.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So at this point, I can only, for myself mostly, because I can't begin to guide you guys, you know, I'm just sharing with you what I'm, you know, what I've read out loud here today, but it's just recognizing that, you know, the previous moment is over. The beginning of our class is gone. It's an hour ago. What's the notion of time? But it's gone, and we're talking now. So this idea of, you know, something beginning and ending, that is our experience. If we begin to really look closer and closer, and that's the best way I think we have to begin to really gain insight, is just continually look at our own personal experience of how our thoughts work, of looking back at our lives, looking back at the different moments in our lives or different time, you know, within our timeline. And, you know, we say that there's no, you know, is there rebirth? Well, the child in me is gone, and yet I'm still existent, but the form I'm existing is now is completely different than that child, and yet I have a sense of a self that somehow that child that I connect with through pictures or vague memories is still somehow me. And that's a psychological sense. What in our actual experience physically, we're completely different.
Right.
So you could look at, you know, birth and rebirth as just how we were 10 years ago and how we are now, or how we were 40 years ago and how we are now. And we're a totally different person. And yet there's this sense, and it's a psychological sense, of it still being me. And I imagine that's what they're referring to.
Yeah, so too. Your aggregates are different.
Completely. You know, and so, like, I know we're at 3:32, so we have to stop. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, that's where I think right now, for me personally, instead of getting hung up about past lives, present lives, future lives, is just looking within this life right now and what we can describe, what's our past life and what will be our future life, and all of these issues of how can we change, you know, where we are now with the set of circumstances we have now, or our set of emotional choices that we make, that we see clearly we can change through training, how not to reinforce as strongly, how to create different habits, and how that will affect us in our future life, in what we call my life right now, in this particular life. That if we continue to study and examine that, we can see that, you know, why are we saying that at the moment of death, our experience won't be just like going to sleep and waking up with a different set of, you know, in our dream state, and yet somehow that will appear as real to us as our waking state does now.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's great. Thanks.
Okay. So that's that. Sorry. That. Yeah, we're finished. Sorry. I don't want to go over time, but.
Okay. Well, I think the discussion just carried us along, and one moment to the next. Here we are. Pema Chodron said it's like we could think of our life as one bardo after another. It's almost like bardos within bardos within bardos. Mm-hmm. If you look at anything, we're in the bardo of our class right now, and we're in the bardo of a particular person asking a particular question. But anyway, are we ready to do the dedication?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay. Let me make sure everybody's muted. Thank you so much, Lama Jinzong.
I hope that was helpful.
It was a fabulous class. Okay, I'm not going to mute myself. I think everybody else is muted. So we will now take a moment to let our minds settle, look directly at our own experience, open up our awareness to accommodate all of our sensory input, including thoughts and emotions. And in that state of mind, we'll dedicate the merit. This merit, may it win omniscience, defeat my faults, the enemy. Then from the rough and stormy sea of birth, old age, death, and disease, from this ocean of samsara, may I liberate all beings. They know things in their true existence, Kuntu, Zangpo, and Manjushri. To train myself in their example, I dedicate this practice fully. May every being through this practice completely gather merit and wisdom, attaining the two sacred bodies that merit and wisdom emanate, the blessings of the Buddhakayas, the blessings of changeless dharmata, the blessings of the steadfast sangha. This dedication please fulfill. Let our minds come to rest once more. And I'm going to unmute everybody.
I agree. That was a great class, Lama Jinzong.
Oh, yes.
Yeah. Excellent. Thank you very much.
Great discussion, everybody.
Yeah, that was
fabulous. Really job fielding all of it, Lama Jinzong.
I mean, I think that the key is what we were saying at the end is whenever you have trouble like trying to imagine something, it's better to just look at your life right now.
Yeah.
Look at your own experience. You know.
And on that note, we'll see you next week for karma.
Okay, bye everybody. Stay well.
Jinzong, do you want to stay on for a second with me?
Sure.
Okay,
sure.
So everybody can just take themselves out one by one. And it's great to see you, Dan.
Thanks,
great
guys.
To see everybody. Flickering stars and candles.